things in the universe to which we grant an authentic vitality, and because of this, we are not fully alive. Thus, Turner shows that taking Native American religion seriously might require re-examination of the Judeo-Christian tradition. No textbook would suggest such a controversial idea. Similarly, textbooks give readers no clue as to what the zone of contact was like from the Native side. They emphasize Native Americans such as Squanto and Pocahontas, who sided with the invaders. And they invert the terms, picturing white aggressors as settlers, and often showing Native settlers as aggressors. The United States Department of Interior had tried to give each tribe both land and money, says The American Way, describing the U.S. policy of forcing tribes to cede most of their land and retreat to reservations. Whites were baffled by Native ingratitude at being offered this land. Way claims, "White Americans couldn't understand the Indians. To them, owning land was a dream come true." In reality, whites of the time were hardly baffled. Even General Philip Sheridan, who is notorious for having said, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian," understood. "We took away their country and their means of support, and it was for this and against this they made war," he wrote. "Could anyone expect less?" The textbooks have turned history upside down. Let's try a right-side-up view. After King Philip's War, there was continuous conflict at the edge of New England. In Vermont, the settlers worried about savages scalping them. This description is accurate, provided the reader understands that the settlers were Native American, the scalpers white. Even the best of our American history books fail to show the climate of white actions within which Native Americans on the border of white control had to live. It was so bad, and Natives had so little recourse, that the Catawbas in North Carolina fled in every direction in 1786 when a solitary white man rode into their village unannounced. And the Catawbas were a friendly tribe. From the opposite coast, here is a story that might help make such dispersal understandable. An old white settler told his son, who was writing about life on the Oregon frontier, about an incident he recalled from the cowboys and Indians days. Some cowboys came upon Indian families without their men present. The cowboys gave pursuit, planning to rape the squaws, as was the custom. One woman, however, pushed sand into her vagina to thwart her pursuers. The act of resistance is what made the incident memorable. Otherwise, it was entirely ordinary. Such ordinariness is what our textbooks leave out. They don't challenge our archetypal Laura Ingalls Wilder picture of peaceful white settlers suffering occasional attacks by brutal Indians. If they did, the fact that so many tribes resorted to war, even after 1815, when resistance was clearly doomed, would become understandable. Our history is full of wars with Native American nations, but not our history textbooks. For almost 200 years, notes David Horowitz, almost continuous warfare raged on the American continent, its conflict more threatening than any the nation was to face again. Indian warfare absorbed 80% of the entire federal budget during George Washington's administration and dogged his successors for a century as a major issue and expense. Yet most of our textbooks barely mention the topic. The American Pageant offers a table of total costs and number of battle deaths of major U.S. wars that completely omits Indian wars. Pageant includes the Spanish-American War, according at a toll of 385 battle deaths, but leaves out the Ohio War of 1790 to 95, which cost 630 dead and missing U.S. troops in a single battle, the Battle of Wabash River. At least today's textbooks no longer blame the natives for all the violence, as did most textbooks written before the Civil Rights Movement. Historians used to say, "Civilized war is the kind we fight against them, whereas savage war is the atrocious kind that they fight against us. Not one of the 12 history books I examined portrays natives as savages. The authors are careful to admit brutality on both sides. Some of the books mention the massacres of defenseless Native Americans at Sand Creek and Wounded Knee. Like the legacy of slavery, the legacy of conquest persists, however. Indeed, conquest ended more recently than slavery, outlasting that unfortunate institution by a quarter century. Slavery is now taken seriously in our histories. Conquest still is not. In this sense, the American Indian movement, unlike the civil rights movement, has failed. Our textbooks don't teach against the archetype of the savage Indian that pervades popular culture. On the contrary, textbooks give very little attention of any kind to Indian wars. As a result, my college students still come up with savage when I ask them for 5 adjectives that apply to Indians. Like much of our knowledge about Native Americans, the savage stereotype comes particularly from Western movies and novels, such as the popular Wagons West series by Dana Fuller Ross. These paperbacks, which have sold hundreds of thousands of copies, claim boldly, "The general outlines of history have been faithfully followed." Titled with state names, Idaho, Utah, etc., the novel's covers warn that marauding Indian bands are spreading murder and mayhem among terror-stricken settlers. In the Hollywood Old West, wagon trains are invariably encircled by savage Indian hordes. In the real West, among 250,000 whites and blacks who journeyed across the plains between 1840 and 1860, only 362 pioneers and 426 Native Americans died in all the recorded battles between the two groups. Much more commonly, Indians gave the new settlers directions, showed them water holes, sold them food and horses, bought cloth and guns, and served as guides and interpreters. These activities are rarely depicted in movies, novels, or our textbooks. Inhaling the misinformation of the popular culture, students have no idea that natives considered European warfare far more savage than their own. In New England's first Indian War, the Pequot War of 1636-1637, provides a case study of the intensified warfare Europeans brought to America. Allied with the Narragansetts, traditional enemies of the Pequots, the colonialists attacked at dawn. Surrounding the Pequot village, whose inhabitants were mostly women, children, and old men, the British set it on fire and shot those who tried to escape the flames. William Bradford described the scene. "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire, and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave praise thereof to God, who had wrought so wonderfully for them." The slaughter shocked the Narragansetts, who had wanted merely to subjugate the Pequots, not exterminate them. The Narragansetts reproached the English for their style of warfare, crying, it is not, because it is too furious, and slays too many men." In turn, Captain John Underhill scoffed, saying that the Narragansett style of fighting was more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies. Underhill's analysis of the role of warfare in Narragansett society was correct, and might accurately be applied to other tribes as well. Through the centuries, whites frequently accused their native allies of not fighting hard enough. The Puritans tried to erase the Pequots even from memory, passing a law making it a crime to say the word Pequot. Bradford concluded proudly, "The rest are scattered, and the Indians in all quarters are so terrified that they are afraid to give them sanctuary." None of these quotations enters our textbooks, which devote an average of 1.25 sentences to this war. Perhaps the most violent Indian war began in 1675, when white New Englanders executed 3 Wampanoag Indians, and the Wampanoags attacked. King Philip's War. One reason for the end of peace was that the fur trade, which had linked natives and Europeans economically, was winding down in Massachusetts. Textbooks could present students with the native side of this conflict by quoting the Wampanoag leader Metacomet, whom the English called King Philip. The English who first came to this country were but a handful of people, forlorn, poor, and distressed. My father was then sachem. He relieved their distresses in the most kind and hospitable manner. He gave them land to plant and build upon. They flourished and increased. By various means they got possessed of a great part of this territory. But he still remained their friend until he died. My elder brother became sachem. He was seized and confined, and thereby thrown into illness and died. Soon after I became sachem, they disarmed all my people. Their land was taken, but a small part of the dominion of my ancestors remains. I am determined not to live until I have no country. This was no minor war. Of some 90 Puritan towns, 52 had been attacked and 12 destroyed. At the end of the war, several thousand English and perhaps twice as many Indians lay dead. King Philip's War cost more American lives in combat, Anglo and native, in absolute terms than the French and Indian War, the Revolution, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, or the Spanish-American War. In proportion to population, casualties were greater than in any other American war. Nonetheless, 5 of the 12 books I surveyed leave it out entirely. Most others give it half a paragraph. War with the Indians started in Acoma, now New Mexico, in 1599, when a Spanish leader avenged the death of his brother by enslaving most of the villagers and chopping off 1 foot of all males over 25 years of age. It spread to the southeast, where, because of fierce and implacable Indian resistance, the Spanish were unable to colonize Florida for over 100 years. Except for a few minor skirmishes, it ceased in 1890 with the massacre at Wounded Knee. Our histories can hardly describe each war, because there were so many. But precisely because there were so many, the way our textbooks minimize the Indian Wars misrepresents our history. The textbooks also reduce the Indianness of some of our other wars. From 1600 to 1754, Europe was often at war, including 3 world wars: the War of the League of Augsburg, 1689 through 1697, known in the United States as King William's War; the War of the Spanish Succession, 1702 to 1713, known here as Queen Anne's War; and the War of the Austrian Succession, 1744 through 1748, known here as King George's War. In North America, the major European powers, England, France, and Spain, buffered from each other by Indian land, fought mainly through their Indian allies. Native Americans inadvertently provided a gift of relative peace to the colonies by absorbing the shock of combat themselves. Another world war, the 7 Years' War, 1754 through 1763, in the United States called the French and Indian War, was also fought in North America mostly by Native Americans on both sides. Native Americans not only fought in the American Revolution, but were its first cause, for the proclamation of 1763, which placated Native American nations by forbidding the colonies from making land grants beyond the Appalachian continental divide, enraged many colonists. They saw themselves as paying to support a British army that only obstructed them from seizing Indian lands on the western frontier. After hostilities with Britain broke out, however, the fledgling United Colonies in 1775 were initially more concerned about relations with Indian nations than with Europe, so they sent Benjamin Franklin first to the Iroquois, then to France. Native Americans also played a large role in the War of 1812 and participated as well in the Mexican War and the Civil War. In each war, natives fought mostly against other natives. In each, the larger number aligned against the colonies, later the United States, correctly perceiving that, for geopolitical reasons, opponents of the United States offered them better chances of being accorded human rights and retaining their land. Even in describing the French and Indian War, textbooks leave out the Indians. One of the worst defeats Indians ever inflicted on white forces was the rout of General Braddock in 1755 in Pennsylvania. Braddock had 1,460 men, including 8 Indian scouts, and a detachment of Virginia militia under George Washington. 600 to 1,000 Native Americans and 290 French soldiers opposed them. But you would never guess any Indians were there from the American tradition. On July 9th, as they were approaching the fort, the French launched an ambush. Braddock's force was surrounded and defeated. The red-coated British soldiers, unaccustomed to fighting in the wilderness, suffered over 900 casualties. Braddock, mortally wounded, murmured as he died, "We shall know better how to deal with them another time." Tradition thus renders Braddock's last words meaningless, for "them" refers not to the French, but to Native Americans. In our Revolution, most of the Iroquois Confederacy sided with the British and attacked white Americans in New York and northern Pennsylvania. In 1778, the United States suffered a major defeat when several hundred Tories and Senecas routed 400 militia and regulars at 40 Fort, Pennsylvania, killing 340. After the Revolution, although Britain surrendered, its Native American allies did not. Our insistence on treating the Indians as if we had defeated them led to the Ohio War of 1790 through 1795, and later to the War of 1812. The never-ending source of dispute was land. To explain this constant conflict, half of the textbooks I examined rely on the cliché that Native Americans held some pre-modern understanding of land ownership. When students are informed that the Dutch bought Manhattan for $24 worth of trade goods, presumably they are meant to smile indulgently. What a bargain! What foolish Indians not to recognize the potential of the island! Not one book points out that the Dutch paid the wrong tribe for Manhattan. Doubtless the Canarsies, native to Brooklyn, were quite pleased with the deal. The Wekwesiks, who lived on Manhattan and really owned the island, weren't so happy. For years afterward, they warred sporadically with the Dutch. Europeans were forever paying the wrong tribe or paying a small faction within a much larger nation. Often they didn't really care. They merely sought justification for theft. Such fraudulent transactions might have worked in their favor, for they frequently set one tribe or faction against another. The biggest single purchase from the wrong tribe took place in 1803. All the textbooks tell how Jefferson doubled the size of the United States by buying Louisiana from France. Not one points out that it was not France's land to sell. It was Indian land. The French never consulted with the native owners before selling. Most Native Americans never even knew of the sale. Indeed, France didn't really sell Louisiana for $15 million. France merely sold its claim to the territory. The United States was still paying Native American tribes for Louisiana throughout the 19th century. We were also fighting them for it. The Army Almanac lists more than 50 Indian wars in the Louisiana Purchase from 1819 to 1890. To treat France as the seller, as all our textbooks do, is Eurocentric. Equally Eurocentric are the maps textbooks use to show the Lewis and Clark expedition. They make Native Americans invisible, implying that the United States bought vacant land from the French. Although the Mandans hosted the expedition during the winter of 1804 to 1805 and the Klatsops did so the next winter, even these tribes drop out. Apparently, Lewis and Clark did it all on their own. Some textbooks chide natives for not understanding that when they sold their land, they transferred not only the agricultural rights, but also the rights to the property's game, fish, and sheer enjoyment. Indians regarded the land in the same way we regard the sea, to quote Land of Promise. Textbook authors seem unaware that most land sales before the 20th century, including sales among whites, transferred primarily the rights to farm, mine, and otherwise develop the land. Undeveloped private land was considered public and accessible to all, within limits of good conduct. Moreover, tribal negotiators typically made sure that deeds and treaties specifically reserved hunting, fishing, gathering, and traveling rights to Native Americans. 6 of the 12 histories I studied avoid this cliché of Indian naivete about land ownership. Showing the influence of the new scholarship in Indian history, several of them point out that the problem lay in whites not abiding by accepted concepts of land ownership. But the textbook authors never developed this isolated admission into a general understanding of Indian wars. The most important cause of the War of 1812, for example, was land. Spanish land, Florida. British land, Canada. But most of all, Indian land. All along the boundary, from Vermont to the Georgia Piedmont, white Americans wanted to push the boundaries of white settlement even farther into the Indian country. The British, on the other hand, wanted to keep a sort of Indian buffer state between the United States and Canada. Only 3 textbooks inquire reasonably into the causes of this war. The others simply repeat the pretext offered by the Madison administration: Britain's refusal to show proper respect to American ships and seamen. Even though it makes no sense. After all, Britain's maritime laws had been in place since 1807 and caused no war until the frontier states sent war hawks. Senators and representatives who promised military action to expand the boundaries of the United States to Congress in 1810. After going on for 2 pages about the alleged maritime reasons for the war, the American tradition admits its puzzlement. The West and the South, oddly enough, were the most anti-British regions of the nation, even though they were the least affected by Britain's policies toward American shipping. Land of Promise is similarly perplexed. Where, you must wonder, were the war hawks of New England? After all, it was New England ships and sailors who bore the brunt of Britain's attacks. Like its predecessors, the War of 1812 cannot be understood so long as its Indian origin is obscured. Whites along the frontier wanted the war, and along the frontier most of the war was fought, beginning in November 1811 with William Henry Harrison's attack on the Shawnees and allied tribes in Indiana, called the Battle of Tippecanoe. The United States fought 5 of the 7 major land battles of the War of 1812, primarily against Native Americans. Nonetheless, unlike Canadian histories, none of our textbooks recognizes the involvement of Native Americans. All but 2 textbooks miss the key result of the war. Some authors actually cite the Star-Spangled Banner as the main outcome. Others claim that the war left a feeling of pride as a nation, or helped Americans to win European respect. The American Adventure excels, pointing out, "The American Indians were the only real losers in the war." Triumph of the American Nation expresses the same sentiments, but euphemistically. After 1815, the American people began the exciting task of occupying the Western lands. The other 10 books simply ignore the key outcome. In return for our leaving Canada alone, Great Britain gave up its alliances with Indian nations in what would become the United States. Without war materiel and other aid from European allies, Future Indian wars were transformed from major international conflicts to domestic mopping-up operations. This result was central to the course of Indian-U.S. relations for the remainder of the century. Thus, Indian wars after 1815, while they cost thousands of lives on both sides, would never again amount to a serious threat to the United States. Although Native Americans won many battles in subsequent wars, there was never the slightest doubt over who would win in the end. Another result of the War of 1812 was the loss of part of our history. A century of learning from Native Americans was coming to a close. A century and more of forgetting, of calling history into service to rationalize conquest, was beginning. After 1815, Indians could no longer play what sociologists call the role of conflict partner, an important other who must be taken into account. So Americans forgot that Indians had ever been significant in our history. Even terminology changed. Until 1815, the word Americans had generally been used to refer to Native Americans. After 1815, it meant European Americans. Ironically, several textbooks that omit King Philip's War and the Native American role in the War of 1812 focus instead on such minor plains wars as Geronimo's Apache War of 1885 through 1886, which involved maybe 40 Apache fighters. The plains wars fit the post-1815 storyline of the textbooks, since they pitted white settlers against semi-nomadic Indians. The Plains Indians are the Native Americans' textbooks love to mourn. Authors can lament their passing while considering it inevitable, hence untroubling. The textbooks also fail to mention how the continuous Indian wars have reverberated through our culture. Carlton Beals has written that our acquiescence in Indian dispossession has molded the American character. As soon as natives were no longer conflict partners, their image deteriorated in the minds of many whites. Karen Kupperman has shown how this process unfolded in Virginia after the Indian defeat in the 1640s. It was the ultimate powerlessness of the Indians, not their racial inferiority, which made it possible to see them as people without rights. Natives who had been ingenious, industrious, and quick of apprehension in 1610 now became slothful and idle, vicious, melancholy, and slovenly. This is another example of the process of cognitive dissonance. Like Christopher Columbus, George Washington changed his attitude toward Indians. Washington held positive views of Native Americans early in his life, but after unleashing the Ohio War in 1790, he would come to denounce the Ohio Indians as having nothing human except the shape. This process of rationalization became unofficial national policy after the War of 1812. In 1845, William Gilmore Sims wrote, "Our blinding prejudices have been fostered as necessary to justify the reckless and unsparing hand with which we have smitten the Indians in their habitations and expelled them from their country." In 1871, Francis A. Walker, Commissioner of Indian Affairs, considered Indians beneath morality. "When dealing with savage men as with savage beasts, no question of national honor can arise." Whatever action the United States cared to take is solely a question of expediency. Thus, cognitive dissonance destroyed our national idealism. From 1815 on, instead of spreading democracy, we exported the ideology of white supremacy. Gradually, we sought American hegemony over Mexico, the Philippines, much of the Caribbean basin, and indirectly over other nations. Although European nations professed to be shocked by our actions on the western frontier, before long they were emulating us. Britain exterminated the Tasmanian Aborigines. Germany pursued total war against the Herero of Namibia. Most Western nations have to face this history. We also have to admit that Adolf Hitler displayed more knowledge of how we treated Native Americans than American high schoolers who rely on their textbooks. Hitler admired our concentration camps for Indians in the West, and often praised to his inner circle the efficiency of America's extermination by starvation and uneven combat as the model for his extermination of Jews and Gypsies. Were there alternatives to this history of war? Of course there were. Indeed, France, Russia, and Spain all pursued different alternatives in the Americas. Since the alternatives to war remain roads largely not taken in the United States, however, they are tricky topics for historians. As Edward Carr noted, history is, by and large, a record of what people did, not of what they failed to do. On the other hand, making the present seem inevitable robs history of all its life and much of its meaning. History is contingent upon the actions of people. The duty of the historian, Gordon Craig has reminded us, is to restore to the past the options it once had. Craig also pointed out that this is an appropriate way to teach history and to make it memorable. White Americans chose among real alternatives and were often divided among themselves. At various points in our history, our anti-Indian policies might have gone another way. For example, one reason the War of 1812 was so unpopular in New England was that New Englanders saw it as a naked attempt by slave owners to appropriate Indian land. Peaceful coexistence of whites and Native Americans presents itself as perhaps the most obvious alternative to war. But was it really possible? In thinking about this question, we must take care not to compare a static Indian culture to changing modern culture. We have seen the rapid changes in independent Native cultures, adaptation to an economy based on hunting and trapping, the flowering of multilingualism, development of more formal hierarchies. Such changes would no doubt have continued. Thus, we're not talking about bow and arrow hunters living side by side with computerized urbanites. We should keep in mind that the thousands of white and black Americans who joined Indian societies must have believed that coexistence was possible. From the start, however, white conduct hindered peaceful coexistence. A thousand little encroachments eventually made it impossible for Indians to farm near whites. Around Plymouth, the Indians leased their grazing land, but retained their planting grounds. Too late, they found that this didn't keep colonists from letting their livestock roam free to ruin the crops. When Native Americans protested, they usually found the colonial courts excluded their testimony. On the other hand, the Indian who dared to kill an Englishman's marauding animals was promptly hauled into a hostile court. The precedent established on the Atlantic coast that Indians weren't citizens of the European state and lacked legal rights prevented peaceful white-Indian coexistence throughout the colonies and later the United States. Even in Indian territory, supposedly under Native control, whether Indians were charged with offenses on white land or whites on Indian land, trial had to be held in a white court in Missouri, miles away. Since many whites had a material interest in dispossessing Indians of their land, and since European and African populations grew ever larger while plagues continued to reduce the Indian population, plainly the United States was going to rule. In this sense, war only prolonged the inevitable. Another alternative to war would have been an express commitment to racial harmony, a predominantly European but non-racist United States that did not differentiate between Indians and non-Indians. U.S. history provides several examples of relatively non-racist enclaves. Sociologists call them tri-racial isolates, because their heritage is white, black, and red, as it were. For centuries, these communities occupied swamps and other undesirable lands, wanting mostly to be left alone. The Revolutionary War hero, Crispus Attucks, was a member of such an enclave. An escaped slave of Wampanoag, European, and African ancestry. The Lumbee Indians in North Carolina comprise the largest such group. Other tri-racial isolates include the Wampanoags in Massachusetts, the Seminoles in Florida, and smaller bands from Louisiana to Maine. The first British settlement in North America, Roanoke Island in 1585, probably didn't die out, but was absorbed into the nearby Croatan Indians, thereby achieving a harmonious biracial society that always eluded colonial planters. Eventually, the English and the Croatans may have become part of the Lumbees. The British never learned the outcome of the lost colony, however. Frederick Turner has suggested that they didn't want to think about the possibility that British settlers had survived by merging with Native Americans. Instead, in the words of J.F. Faust, tales of the lost colony came to epitomize the treacherous nature of hostile Indians and served as the mythopoeic bloody shirt for justifying aggressions against the Powhatan years later. Tri-racial isolates have generally won only contempt from their white neighbors, which is why they have chosen rural isolation. Our textbooks isolate them, too. None mentions the term or the peoples. A related possibility for natives, Europeans, and Africans was intermarriage. Alliance through marriage is a common way for two societies to deal with each other, and Indians in the United States repeatedly suggested such a policy. Spanish men married native women in California and New Mexico and converted them to Spanish ways. French fur traders married native women in Canada and Illinois and converted to native ways. Not the British. The textbooks might usefully pass on to students the old cliché. The French penetrated Indian societies, the Spanish acculturated them, and the British expelled them, for it offers a largely accurate summary of European-Indian relationships. In New England and Virginia, English colonists quickly moved to forbid interracial marriage. Pocahontas stands as the first and almost the last native to be accepted into British American society, which we may therefore call white society, through marriage. After her, most interracial couples found greater acceptance in native society. There, their children often became chiefs because their bicultural background was an asset in the complex world the tribes now had to navigate. In Anglo society, half-breeds were not valued, but stigmatized. Another alternative to war was the creation of an Indian state within the United States. In 1778, when the Delaware Indians proposed that Native Americans be admitted to the Union as a separate state, Congress refused even to consider the idea. In the 1840s, Indian Territory sought the right enjoyed by other territories to send representatives to Congress, but white Southerners stopped them. The Confederacy won the backing of most Native Americans in Indian Territory, however, by promising to admit the territory as a state if the South won the Civil War. After the war, Native Americans proposed the same arrangement to the United States. Again, the United States said no, but eventually admitted Indian Territory as the white-dominated state of Oklahoma. Ironically, the name means Land for Red People in Choctaw. Our textbooks pay no attention to any of these possibilities. Instead, they dwell on another road not taken, total one-way acculturation to white society. The overall storyline in contemporary American history textbooks about American Indians is this. We tried to Europeanize them. They wouldn't or couldn't do it. So we dispossessed them. While more sympathetic than the account in earlier textbooks, this account falls into the trap of repeating as history the propaganda used by policymakers in the 19th century as a rationale for removal, that Native Americans stood in the way of progress. The only real difference is the tone. Back when white Americans were doing the dispossessing, justifications were shrill. They denounced native cultures as primitive, savage, and nomadic. Often writers invoked the hand or blessings of God, said to favor those who did more with the land. Now that the dispossessing is done, our histories can see more virtue in the conquered cultures, but they still picture Indians as tragically different, unable or unwilling to acculturate. American history tells of misguided liberals who tried to get the Indians to settle down on farms and become good Americans. They wanted Indians to give up their customs and religions and copy the culture of the whites. They didn't care that this would destroy the Indians as a distinct group of people. They believed that the change would be the best thing that could happen to both the Indians and to their white neighbors on the frontier. American history appears to offer a sympathetic treatment of a tragic clash of two irreconcilable lifestyles in the Ohio Valley around 1800. This treatment mimics President Thomas Jefferson, who told a delegation of Cherokees in 1808, "Let me entreat you, therefore, on the lands now given you, to begin every man a farm. Let him enclose it, cultivate it, build a warm house on it, and when he dies, let it belong to his wife and children after him." Other textbooks share Jefferson's view and lament that if only the Indians had become farmers like us, everything would have turned out better. Triumph of the American Nation commiserates, "Two such different ways of life could not long exist peaceably side by side. Conflict was inevitable." The trouble is, it wasn't like that. The problem wasn't native failure to acculturate. In reality, many European Americans didn't really want Indians to acculturate. It wasn't in their interest. At times, this was obvious, as when the Massachusetts legislature in 1789 passed a law prohibiting teaching Native Americans how to read and write under penalty of death. The United States claimed to be willing to teach the Indians to farm, but Indians in Ohio already were farmers. American history fails to mention that the Cherokees were visiting Jefferson precisely to ask the president to assign their lands to them in severalty as individual farms, and to make them citizens. Jefferson put them off. John Peterson has pointed out that a visitor catching sight of a Mississippi farm in 1820 would have had no way of knowing whether it was European or Choctaw until the farmers themselves came into view. The Choctaws didn't need to settle down. The American Way asks students, why were the Indians moved further west? Its teacher's edition provides the answer. They were moved so the settlers could use the land for growing crops. We might add this catechism. What were the Indians doing on the land? They were growing crops. When Jefferson spoke to the Cherokees, whites had been burning native houses and cornfields for 186 years, beginning in Virginia in 1622. No matter how thoroughly Native Americans acculturated, they could not succeed in white society. Whites wouldn't let them. Indians were always regarded as aliens, and were rarely allowed to live within white society except on its periphery. Native Americans who amassed property, owned European-style homes, perhaps operated sawmills, merely became the first targets of white thugs who coveted their land and improvements. In time of war, the position of assimilated Indians grew particularly desperate. Consider Pennsylvania. During the French and Indian War, the Susquehannas, living peaceably in white towns, were hatcheted by their neighbors, who then collected bounties from authorities who weren't careful whose scalp they were paying for, so long as it was Indian. Through the centuries and across the country, this pattern recurred. In 1860, for instance, California ranchers killed 185 of the 800 Wiyotes, a tribe allied with the whites, because they were angered by other tribes' cattle raids. Occasionally, textbooks acknowledge that most Native Americans were settled, but they don't let these settled Indians interfere with the traditional storyline. Early on, American history admits that the Ohio Indians were farmers, Unlike the tribes who lived by hunting, many of these Indians had taken up farming. For them, moving would mean more than having to find another hunting ground. But 40 pages later, when trying to rationalize the Indians' removal, they tried to get Indians to settle down on farms and become good Americans. If the author of American History cannot remember from one chapter to the next that the Indians didn't need to settle down, we can hardly expect his readers to. The storyline is too powerful an archetype. Most of the textbooks I studied describe the acculturation achieved by the Indians of the Southeast, the five civilized tribes, and point out that the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole nations were exiled to Oklahoma anyway. Nonetheless, our culture and our textbooks still stereotype Native Americans as roaming, primitive hunting folk, unfortunate victims of progress. Ironically, to Native eyes, Europeans were nomads. As Chief Seattle put it in 1855, "To us the ashes of our ancestors are sacred, and their resting place is hallowed ground. You wander far from the graves of your ancestors, and seemingly without regret." In contrast, Indian roaming consisted mainly of moving from summer homes to winter homes and back again. One way to understand why acculturation couldn't work for most natives is to imagine that the United States allowed lawless discrimination against all people whose last name starts with the letter L. How long would we last? The first non-L people who wanted our homes or jobs could force us out, and we would be without resources. People around us would then blame us L people for being vagrants. That's what happened to Native Americans. In Massachusetts, colonists were constantly tempted to pick quarrels with Indian families because the result was likely to be acquiring their land. In Oregon, 240 years later, the process continued. 10,000 whites had moved on to the Nez Perce Reservation by 1862, so a senator from Oregon suggested that the United States should remove the nation. Senator William Fessenden of Maine pointed out the problem. "There is no difficulty, I take it, in Oregon in keeping men off the lands that are owned by white men. But when the possessor happens to be an Indian, the question is changed altogether. Without legal rights, acculturation cannot succeed." Chief Joseph said this eloquently. "We ask that the same law shall work alike on all men. If an Indian breaks the law, punish him by the law. If a white man breaks the law, punish him also. Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade where I choose, free to talk and think and act for myself." It was not to be. Most courts simply refused to hear testimony from Native Americans against whites. After noting how non-Indians could rise through the ranks of Native societies, Peter Farb summed up the possibilities in white society. At almost no time in the history of the United States, though, were the Indians afforded similar opportunities for voluntary assimilation. The acculturated Indian simply stood out as a target. The authors of history textbooks occasionally announced their intentions in writing. In the teacher's edition of The American Way, for instance, Nancy Bauer states, "It is the goal of this book that its readers will understand America, be proud of its strengths, be pleased in its determination to improve, and welcome the opportunity to join as active citizens in the American way." That the author could not possibly pay reasonable attention to Indian history follows logically. It's understandable that textbook authors might write history in such a way that students can feel good about themselves by feeling good about the past. Feeling good is a human need, but it imposes a burden that history cannot bear without becoming simple-minded. Casting Indian history as a tragedy because Native Americans couldn't or wouldn't acculturate is feel-good history for whites. By downplaying Indian wars, textbooks help us forget that we wrested the continent from Native Americans. today's college students, when asked to compile a list of U.S. wars, never think to include Indian wars, individually or as a whole. The Indian White Wars that dominated our history from 1622 to 1815, and were of considerable importance until 1890, have disappeared from our national memory. The answer to minimizing the Indian Wars is not maximizing them. Telling Indian history as a parade of white villains might be feel-good history for those who want to wallow in the inference that America or whites are bad. What happened is more complex than that, however. So the history we tell must be more complex. Textbooks are beginning to reveal some of the division among whites that lent considerable vitality to the alternatives to war. Seven of the textbooks tell of Roger Williams of Salem, who in the 1630s challenged Massachusetts to renounce its royal patent to the land, asserting, "The natives are the true owners of it, unless they sold it." The Puritans renounced Williams, and he fled to Rhode Island. Five textbooks mention Helen Hunt Jackson, who in 1881 paid to provide copies of her famous Indictment of Our Native American Policies, A Century of Dishonor, to every member of Congress. Eight of the textbooks tell how Andrew Jackson and John Marshall waged a titanic struggle over Georgia's attempt to subjugate the Cherokees. Chief Justice Marshall found for the Cherokees, whereupon President Jackson ignored the court, reputedly with the words, "John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it." But no textbook brings any suspense to the issue as one of the dominant questions throughout our first century as a nation. None tells how several Christian denominations, Quakers, Shakers, Moravians, some Presbyterians, and a faction of the Whig Party mobilized public opinion on behalf of fair play for the Native Americans. By ignoring the Whigs, textbooks make the Cherokee removal seem inevitable. Another example of unacculturated Aborigines helpless in the way of progress. Native Americans would have textbooks note that, despite all the wars, the plagues, the pressures against their cultures, Indians still survive, physically and culturally, and still have government-to-government relations with the United States. As recently as 1984, a survey of American history textbooks complained that contemporary issues important to Native peoples were entirely excluded. The books I examined were somewhat better. The American Indian Movement spurred three major Indian takeovers in the early 1970s: Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C., and Wounded Knee, South Dakota. 9 of the 12 textbooks mention at least one of these incidents. The American Tradition and Triumph of the American Nation competently explain the causes and results of all three. 7 of the 12 textbooks make a reasonable attempt to cover the principal issues facing Native Americans in the 20th century. Discovering American History and Triumph of the American Nation do a good job. Life and Liberty and Discovering American History offer maps showing Native American lands today. Anti-Indian racism has eased considerably in the 20th century. Ironically, the very fact that the United States is beginning to let Natives acculturate successfully, albeit in Anglo terms, poses a new threat to Native coexistence. Poverty and discrimination helped isolate Indians. If Native Americans can now get good jobs, as some can, buy new vehicles and satellite televisions, as some have, and commute to the city for part of their life, as some do, it's much harder to maintain the intangible values that make up the core of Indian cultures. Only one textbook raises perhaps the key question now facing Native Americans. Can distinctively Indian cultures survive? Discovering American History treats this issue in an exemplary way, inviting students to experience the dilemma through the words of Native American teenagers. The other textbooks cannot raise this issue because they remain locked in non-Indian sources and a non-Indian interpretive framework. Textbooks still define Native Americans in opposition to civilization, and still conceive of Indian cultures in what anthropologists call the ethnographic present, frozen at the time of white contact. When textbooks show sympathy for the tragic struggle of American Indians to maintain their way of life, they exemplify this myopia. Native Americans never had a way of life. They had many. Indians wouldn't have maintained those ways unchanged over the last 500 years, even without European and African immigration. Indians have long struggled to change their ways of life. That autonomy we took from them. Even today we divide Native American leadership into progressives, who want to acculturate, and traditionals, who want to remain Indian. Textbook authors don't put other Americans into this straitjacket. We non-Indians choose what we want from the past or from other cultures. We jettisoned our medical practices of the 1780s while retaining the Constitution. But Native American medical practitioners who abandon their traditional ways to embrace pasteurization from France and antibiotics from England are seen as compromising their Indianness. We can alter our modes of transportation or housing while remaining American. Indians cannot and stay Indian in our eyes. Improved histories might increase the chances for syncretism on both sides of our ideological frontier. If we knew the extent to which Indian ideas have shaped American culture, the United States might recognize Native American societies as cultural assets from which we could continue to learn. At present, none of our textbooks hints at this possibility. Even the more enlightened ones merely champion better treatment for Indians and stop short of suggesting that our society might still benefit from Indian ideas. Even if no natives remained among us, however, it would still be important for us to understand the alternatives foregone, to remember the wars, and to learn the unvarnished truth about white Indian relations. Indian history is the antidote to the pious ethnocentrism of American exceptionalism, the notion that European Americans are God's chosen people. Indian history reveals that the United States and its predecessor British colonies have wrought great harm in the world. We must not forget this, not to wallow in our wrongdoing, but to understand and to learn that we might not wreak harm again. We must temper our national pride with critical self-knowledge, suggests Christopher Vecchi. The study of our contact with Indians, the envisioning of our dark American selves, can instill such a strengthening doubt. History through red eyes offers our children a deeper understanding than comes from encountering the past as a story of inevitable triumph by the good guys. Chapter 5. Gone with the Wind. The invisibility of racism in American history textbooks. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, and if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Maya Angelou. The black-white rift stands at the very center of American history. It is the great challenge to which all our deepest aspirations to freedom must rise. If we forget that, if we forget the great stain of slavery that stands at the heart of our country, our history, our experiment, we forget who we are, and we make the great rift deeper and wider. Ken Burns. We have got to the place where we cannot use our experiences during and after the Civil War for the uplift and enlightenment of mankind. W.E.B. Du Bois. More Americans have learned the story of the South during the years of the Civil War and Reconstruction from Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind than from all of the learned volumes on this period. Warren Beck and Miles Clowers. When was the country we now know as the United States first settled? If we forget the lesson of the last chapter for the moment, that Native Americans settled, the best answer might be 1526. In the summer of that year, 5